You're listening to a BBC Five Live podcast.
If you like this, you might also like this.
Eye of the Storm with Emma Barnett.
Every day we're covering some sort of storm that changes people's lives forever. To find out more about our range of podcasts, click, tap or swipe bbc.co.uk/5live.
Fevzi Turkalp is with us for the next hour, continuing to take your tech questions. 08085 909 693 is the telephone number. You can send us a text as well on 85058. Fevzi, if I might be permitted an indulgence and tell you a tale, I am trying, I hope my wife's not listening because she says I buy too much junk, as she says. I am trying to find, I really want to get a 486. I really want an old PC to play old PC games. So I would love to hear in the next hour from somebody, if there's anybody out there that is still running an old PC, maybe a first generation Pentium or a 486, maybe even something older than that, maybe even an old 386. If there's someone out there who's still got one, maybe you could give me a spot of advice. I'd love to hear from you. 08085 909 693. Maybe you could even put the phone against the hard drive and hear that wonderful old hard drive crunching sound.
You know, there's a lot of this sort of retro stuff that goes on, and it makes me feel very old because the first computer, the first PC I bought, my first computer was, funnily enough, was a BBC Micro with 32K of RAM.
Oh, I loved BBC Micros. I had one at
£350, which was a lot of money in 1981, I think it was. But my first PC was a 286 Tower business computer, and it cost £3,000.
Whoa.
And that was in the 80s.
That's a lot of machine. I think I started with a Pentium 133. That was what I started off with.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in terms of old operating systems and old software, because you know the problem is that old software tends to stop running on more recent operating systems.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't give you quite the same vibe, but you can run old operating systems like Windows 95 or even Windows 3.1 in virtual machines. That's to say you run it in a box in your operating, so you can run a Windows 7 or 10 machine. You can even do it on a Mac if you've got software called Parallels. Mm. You can run Android, you can run Windows in a window, as it were, and it's sort of what they call sandbox, so it's safe. It doesn't interfere with the rest of the machine. So although it will have security vulnerabilities and so forth, hopefully they won't escape. But you can run all these esoteric operating systems, various distributions of the Linux operating system, for example, if you're not sure which one you want, you can try them all out. There's software on the PC called Box. There's software called VMware, which runs on PCs and Mac, and on Mac only is Parallels. And the nice thing about Parallels, by the way, is it lets you use a lot of the nice things about the Mac in the environment of the Windows PC in the box. So, for example, you can use the swipes and gestures that are made for Mac within Windows, which is a very neat trick. And it's very much easier to transfer information between the operating systems as well. So, you know, I'm always a fan of that on Macintoshes, but on PCs you can get free software like Box, and you can run these things in a box.
Something about the old hardware, though, I think.
There is the smell of the power supply.
The slightly yellowed beige case.
You know, it's quite interesting.
Turbo buttons on
it. I'm quite a fan of old synthesizer equipment.
Yes.
And some of the stuff now from the sort of, that dates back to the 80s and 90s, before the days of USB drives and thumb drives and all that, memory cards, they were using 3.5-inch floppy disks. And these floppy disks are starting to get a little bit difficult to get hold of. So
it's incredibly hard to find. I mean, there must have been millions of old 486s around in businesses and homes. You cannot find them for love nor money. They're really, you'd think they'd be 10 a penny on a well-known auction site, but really hard to find. Quite a few in America. Very hard to find here. So, if you've got one still running somewhere in your loft, maybe give us a call. 08085 909 693. Let's go to the phones. Richard's in Ellsbury. Richard, good morning.
It's Winslow, but close
enough. I'm so sorry. I do apologise. Well, nice part of the world. Richard, what's your question for Fevzi?
Yeah, do you want to know what key I'm running?
Go ahead.
Aspire 5750 with Windows Starter on it, but I upgraded to Windows 2000. With Office Starter on it, 2010 for printing, and I upgraded to Office 2016 last year, and a Samsung laser printer. Problem I'm getting, I cannot print properly off it, and I don't know if there's a clash between the Office Starter and the Office 2016 that I downloaded last year. I've been having serious problems trying to print. It just refuses to let me print documents.
Right.
And I've got one up here now. Shall I go through the nonsense I get when I try and print it?
Tell me.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Okay. So it's an email message from someone, 17 pages. So if I right-click to print, we go to print, and we've got a loading preview. Up with the preview, hit print button. First of all, I get to the page on the preview page of my email address that I don't want.
Yes.
So if I scroll down to the next page, which is page 2, all I'm getting is 2 pages to print, no more.
Yeah.
Can't print all of it.
Okay, so you said this is an Aspire laptop. Is it is a laptop?
Yeah, 5750
Aspire. It's an Acer Aspire, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Aspire is the range name, just like Satellite was from Toshiba, Aspire is for Acer. And how old is this machine, Richard?
About 4 years.
About 4 years. And what operating system is it currently running?
Windows 7.
Okay. So
I did actually try and upgrade when with 10 when it was free.
Yeah.
On 2 occasions, I got dreadful problems with printing, so I killed off Windows 10 on
Windows
each occasion.
10. I'll say this for other people: Windows 10 is best run on machines that are sold to you with Windows 10 on it.
Oh, really?
Upgrading.
So should I not add it onto this machine?
No, I wouldn't, because 7 is solid, and it will be supported for the reasonable lifetime of your hardware as well. A few more years in Windows 7 support. If you said to me, I've got Windows XP, then I'd say quickly upgrade. But even then, I'd probably suggest you go to Windows 7 because. In theory, you know, Windows 10 should run, but it depends on how assiduous Acer have been in providing the necessary software drivers. That's to say, the little twiddly bits of software that describe each of the components that comprise your PC to the Windows operating system. If those drivers are not Windows 10 compatible or not fully Windows 10 compatible, then you get all sorts of problems. To my mind, Windows 10 would give you very little benefit and is much more likely to cause you a lot of heartache. So these days,
on 2 occasions.
Yeah, so my advice would be, if you buy a new machine, you've got very little choice. It will almost certainly come with Windows 10 on it, unless, of course, you buy a Mac.
Would it be worth buying a new one? I can do that, because I've got a friend who's got 3 licensed Windows 10, and she said I can have one of her copies, and I was thinking of putting that on, but you're suggesting that's not a good idea.
I really wouldn't, because there's no burning benefit to you,
you know,
because also don't forget your machine is a few years old, so it's going to struggle with some of the nicer features of Windows 10. Plus, Windows 10 is arguably the most successful piece of spyware ever produced. When Windows 10 installs, the way that it's set up by default is to learn as much about you and how you, where you are and how you're using that computer as possible. And it's an interesting story, because Microsoft always used to poke and criticize Google, because Google's business model was predicated on giving free products, but then using those products to learn about you, your location, your shopping habits, everything, your browsing habits. You know, they say that if your daughter's pregnant, Google will know before you do. I would posit that they'll know who the father is as well. But they really know so much about you. And Microsoft always used to say, they criticized them because Microsoft was proud. It was selling operating systems, and it made its money out selling operating systems and Office and software. But what happened was the mobile revolution came, Android came along, and iOS came along from Apple, and suddenly people fell out of the habit of having to pay for operating systems. They were used to getting it free, and it wasn't really free, because they were giving up their personal information, particularly with, not so much with iOS, because you're paying for the hardware with that. That's how their business model works. But with Android is made by Google, and the reason why Google give that away to manufacturers of smartphones to install is because, again, it's a way that they can get information which they then use to target advertising, and that's how they make their money. So I would say that the way that, so having criticized Google for so long, Microsoft now have settled upon a very similar business model to Google, in that they've decided they're going to make money out of monetizing the information that you leak as you use Windows 10. If you know how, you can clean up Windows 10 to a reasonably good extent in terms of stopping it from passing on all sorts of information about you. But certain things you can't easily stop. So, for example, if you want to use their voice assistant called Cortana, which is their equivalent of Siri or Alexa, and sorry for waking up all those devices as I've said those words, but then you have to leave the location information on, so it needs to know where you are. It doesn't need to know, but it won't work without it. So I would say leave well alone, stick with your Windows 7. Most of my machines still run Windows 7 by choice. I had every opportunity to take them to Windows 10. I have one or two Windows 10 machines, but just because I need to keep up with Windows 10 and developments on it. But really, I think Microsoft have to give up on this their sinful ways, as it were, and perhaps respect their customer base a little bit more, in my personal opinion. So until then, I don't think you should have a mad rush to Windows 10. When you buy your next machine, it'll probably have Windows 10 on it anyway. So and it will run better than trying to upgrade your existing machine. Sorry, I gave you a big long story there, but
it's just
interesting the way it's changed.
So
to try and answer your question, having given you a history lesson, so you asked me, should I go buy another machine? No, not for this reason. We can probably solve this. It could be that you haven't got the right drivers installed for that printer. So again, for your computer to recognize the printer and know how to send documents to it, you need a driver which is specific not only to that printer, but also to the version of the operating system that you're running. So for example, in your case, it could be 32-bit or 64-bit Windows 7. So you have to make sure you've got the right drivers installed. The best way to do that is to go to the printer manufacturer's website and carefully download the correct version. You also mentioned that you've got two versions of Office still on there, the starter version and the 2016 version. I would say you probably don't need to have the starter version installed on there. I doubt that it's the cause of the problem, but generally unnecessary to have it on there. And the other thing that you can do as an experiment is you could download a free Office suite, such as LibertyOffice, which is free and it's compatible with Word and Excel and PowerPoint as well, I think, and see if it will print via that. If it prints via that, then we know it's something to do with the Office software. If it doesn't print via that, it would tend to suggest it's the printer driver. But in this case, I would, in any event, there's no harm in going to the manufacturer. Who makes the printer?
It's Samsung Color Laser CLX.
Okay.
6260 FW.
So you go to the Samsung website, go to the support section, find that specific model, make sure it's the same model, and there will be several versions of the driver. Download and install the version of the driver that's pertinent both to your machine and to the version of Windows that you are running. If it offers you a 32-bit and a 64-bit version, make sure you download the version that is what you're running. Yeah, because even that can cause a problem.
The printer's very happy with an awful lot of documents, but not all of them. And on this one now, it's just given me the option of, although that download on the email was 17 pages long, it's only given me the option of printing two pages. And the first one is the email page covering all of the stuff on my email with the information on the left that I don't want. So I'm only
I understand, Richard. That could be down to many things, but the Office software suite is pretty solid. In my view, that what you've described could be caused by a driver issue.
Okay.
And even if it's not the cause of the issue, there's no harm in having the latest version of the driver anyway, and it will just exclude one more thing. If the driver update doesn't solve it, then download LibertyOffice and just try that and see if it solves the problem. If the problem goes away with LibertyOffice, then we need to look more closely at your Office suite and how that's been installed and set up.
And possibly get rid of Starter.
Yeah, I just think because there's no need for it. I mean, don't get rid of it immediately till you've solved the problem, but because I think it's unlikely to be the cause. But if you tried everything else, you could get rid of it and see if that solved it, but that's less likely. It's just that it's going to be you know, taking up storage space on your hard drive, and it might even have a few things running in the background, slowing down the machine. So simple is better if you don't use a piece of software. It's, you know, don't have two, for example, don't have two antivirus programs running at the same time on the computer. It's similarly, you know, two versions of Office, not ideal. Actually, there can be clashes. So, you know, if the other bits of advice don't work, do it, uninstall the starter.
Craig, that sounds good. Can I throw a couple of quickies at you?
Yeah, I'm incapable of answering quickly, but give it a go.
Okay. Well, the first one is that you were talking to your previous caller about charging with mini USBs. Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the magnetic ones you can buy.
What, the ones that dock magnetically, like a bit like the MagSafe connector on an Apple laptop?
Yeah, I've got one. I think I bought two of them via a well-known online site, £5 for two, and I use one. You put the little pins into my phone, and I sit with it by the wherever I sit at night and use it all the time, for my phone's on 24/7. And A, it's a doddle to connect. I don't have a problem putting little USB connectors in, but for those that do have a physical problem with eyesight or whatever, this is an absolute godsend. Yeah. It's such a fast charger.
It can be.
It's the best bit of gear I've ever bought.
Yeah, no, it can be. But again, you've got to make sure you've got good quality, you know, kit there.
Cable. Because charge is quite fast.
Yeah, I mean, fast is not always, you know, the best thing. You know, in broad terms, the faster you charge a battery, the more you shorten its life, because it tends to generate more heat, and the heat dissipates with more difficulty the faster it charges, and therefore you can. I'm not saying, you know, there is a rating for a device and what it expects, but if you charge something too quickly, you know, even on a charger for, you know, double A's and treble A's, you often get two charging speeds, and the reason for the slow charging speed is because it will keep the battery in better condition and give it a longer life. But what I was also going to say to you, you mentioned people who have trouble with fiddly connectors on phones.
Dexterity problems.
Yeah, there is a manufacturer of smartphones called Doro. I think they're Swedish, D-O-R-O. They make devices, smartphones and non-smartphones, that are specifically designed for older users. So they have the right sort of buttons, the right sort of printing, the right sort of screen, even the right software that talks you through in English how to actually set up the phone. It just asks you English questions. And a lot of their devices come with a docking cradle. So you don't have, the charging cable goes into the dock, but it stays there permanently, and you just drop the phone into the cradle, a bit like a home quarters phone. Yeah, a bit like home quarters phone. Yeah, exactly.
Like I'm using now. Yes, I know what you mean now.
So they're quite good for charging, because then, you know, you just drop it in the cradle, they charge up, and it's got a big light on the cradle that shows you when it's fully charged and when it's still charging. So those tend to be good solutions for a number of reasons. So if anyone's got older members of their family who've maybe struggled, the phones are quite interesting, because they have ones that they get so simple to use as people, you know, have more difficulty. They've even got a phone where it hasn't got a numeric keypad on it, it's just got four buttons A, B, C, and D, with rooms to put pictures of the people next to it, and that's great. And one of those phones even has a fall detector in it, so if you're talking about an elderly member of the family or loved one, it can detect a fall if they're holding the phone. When they fall, they don't have to press the emergency button. And some of them have also got GPS trackers in it, so if you've got people that tend to go walk about, they can be literally lifesavers, those sorts of devices.
Great. And the last one was, my email address is christianname.surname@talk21.com, which I've had since the year dot, about 25 years.
Yeah.
Now it's been taken over by this, that, and the other. And I'm being charged £5 a month for the pleasure of it by BT. Now, I seem to remember when I got this, it was free for life, because way back 25 years ago, they were encouraging you to get email addresses. And in those days, you could get your first name dot second name.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, John Smith 958 at whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I'd do about that. I did have emails about a year ago threatening to kill my email address unless I continued paying, and I complained and they reduced it to £1.80, but now it's shot back up to a fiver. It's not the money, it's the principle of the thing. Do you know what I can do about it?
Yeah, well, I think you should bite the bullet and change the email address sooner rather than later, and do it in a controlled way, because there's nothing to say that they won't stop supporting that range of email addresses as well. They're obviously legacy emails, and they may kill it, and you may have no choice but to go elsewhere. Plus, you're having to pay, and £5 a month is a lot for an email address. Yeah, it's £60 a year. It's a lot of money in my view for an email. So there are free options that you can get. So obviously things like Gmail are excellent, as long as you don't mind Google scanning the contents of your emails.
But, sorry, you're a bit faint there.
Sorry, as long as you don't mind Google scanning the contents of your emails, Gmail is a very good email address because it has a particularly good spam filter. Or another way of doing it, which is not free but gives you the best flexibility, is to register a domain name, which will typically cost you something like £10 a year. And then you can, so let's say your name was, Snetterton Lewis.
So I'm awfully faint again.
I'm sorry, is my audio not coming up okay?
That's great now.
Okay, I don't know why. Am I fading in and out, Tom?
No, he's coming through loud and clear to me.
That's fine now.
Concerned. Okay, I shall speak more closely to the microphone. Forgive my plosives. If you register a domain name, such as snettertonlewis.com, then you could have richard@snettertonlewis.com. And even if you change the underlying provider of that email address, it doesn't matter, because you'll never have to change the email again, because you control the domain for as long as you pay that £10 a month or whatever it is. So that's quite a sophisticated way, because then you could use Gmail, for example, but all your Gmail incoming email would just... It would arrive in the Gmail box via the Snetterton Lewis box.
Existing email address name.
Yeah. So in brief, my advice is I would bite the bullet. I'd find a good email provider. I like Gmail, if you don't mind the privacy concerns, or pay for one but control it yourself, because my fear is that they will stop supporting that email address at some point in the future.
There you go, Richard.
The thing that upsets me is that my name is, for argument's sake, John Dot Smith, and I'm never going to get John Dot Smith elsewhere. It will be John Dot Smith 958.
Yes, but don't forget, if you that may be true if you're going for Gmail and stuff, because even if I do fevzi.turkalp, they'll still insist on putting 327 after it, as if there's 326 other Fevzi Turkalps that have registered with them. So the way round that is to go the route of registering a domain. So even if your surname wasn't rare and you can't have that domain, you could have john@john.smith.com, for example. You do john.smith.com, you register that, and then you just put your first name on it. So we could have tom@tomdgreen.com, for example. So that would be the way that I would go, because it gives you the best opportunity to choose your email address, and it means that you control it as long as you pay an annual subscription, which, as I say, is about a tenner a year, and then you can use a free service underneath it. So all that happens is you give people john@john.smith.com as your email address. They send you emails, and that just forwards it into the free Gmail inbox. And the nice thing about Gmail is that the spam filter is best of breed. It really is good at filtering out spam.
I do have a Gmail address. The annoying thing is that I was given this free for life 25 years ago.
Yeah, but the company that did that deal with you doesn't exist anymore, and therefore that, I don't suppose that BT would be bound by that agreement.
Oh, dear.
Richard, thank you very much for giving us a call.
Really helpful. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, Richard. Bye now.
Good to talk to you, Richard. We're going to talk to Rebecca after the news and sport. Just a quick couple of bits of housekeeping. Remember Graham we spoke to about an hour ago, had his problem with his router. He says he's phoned the company, who we won't name, responsible, and they are coming around tomorrow to change the router. So that is one happy customer. Great. He says, thanks, Fevzi. That is from Graham.
He did that now, and they answered.
Yeah, I'm quite impressed that they've got 24-hour, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Should
that's
name
pretty
the
impressive.
Company and give
all right,
on the back.
It's Virgin Media. Pat on the back.
Well
for Virgin
done, Virgin.
Media.
Yes.
Yeah, well done. Helen has also been in touch as well, saying, can we get Fevzi sessions through iPlayer or podcasts? I find his advice so helpful and easy to understand. That's why he's so great. You can indeed, Fevzi. We podcast everything, don't you? It's under Let's Talk About Tech. So if you've got a podcast app or on iTunes or however you get your podcasts, just search for Let's Talk About Tech. And you'll find past pods there. So,
yes, and even if you don't use podcasts and haven't set up for that, you can just do a Google search for Let's Talk About Tech, BBC Five Live, and you can actually download recent shows. Because the good thing about the Let's Talk About Tech is it's an umbrella for all the other tech output on the channel as well. So you'll get better people on there as well. So
well, you're so modest. And you can always follow Fevzi as well, at Gadget Detective on Twitter, isn't it, Fevzi? So
indeed. Thank
lots
you.
Of wonderful yeah. things on there.
You're listening to a BBC Five Live podcast.
If you like this, you might also like this.
The Five Live Football Daily.
Don't forget, you can continue the footballing conversation on social media. Just search for at Five Live Sport.
To find out more about our range of podcasts, click, tap or swipe bbc.co.uk/5live.
Rebecca is in Somerset and has been waiting patiently. Rebecca, good morning.
Good morning to you. I'm having the same problem that your last caller, Richard's having, in that you're fading in and out. Not only the Gadget Detective, but also you, Tom.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that's a transmission issue, Rebecca. Are you hearing that through the phone or through the radio?
I'm listening to you through the phone.
Okay.
I think you need to put 10p in the meter.
Well, hopefully, well, we can certainly hear you, Rebecca. So if you get your question out, hopefully Fevzi can shout his answer at you.
All right, then. Yes, you know, when I'm watching YouTube and I'm really entranced with something and then you can't save it, I wondered if the Gadget Detective would know where I could, like, make a My YouTube or something, where I could save something. So when I come back, I could actually go back and watch it, continue watching it.
Yeah, so Rebecca, there are ways of doing this. The proper way, as it were, is not to save it, but to sign in, to create an account and sign into YouTube. And each time you use it, then you can have a sort of library of favourites and so forth that you can then go back and visit. But instead of saving them physically on your device, which will start to take up quite a lot of space, you'll just be streaming them at the time. The disadvantage of that is that you need to have internet access when you want to watch it, and it needs to restream. There are third-party apps that will do that, but probably best not for me not to go into too much detail about that, because Google don't like people doing it, and I suspect it's against their terms of service as well, because obviously what they want is for you to be logged on and for them to have information about what you watch, how many times, from where and when, and if you're able to download it or not. So I shall simply say to you that there are many third-party applications that will grab YouTube videos and save them on your local hard drive or solid-state drive or tablet. But what I would say also is that they do tend to be, they do start clogging up a computer locally, unless you've got a particularly capacious hard drive. You'll find that after a while those videos are taking up too much space. So, the cheap way and the way to start...
The thing is, I'm watching YouTube on my normal, on my telly, on my smart TV.
Okay, so how would you save it then? If you're watching it on a smart TV, you're not using a computer or a tablet at that point, you wouldn't have anything to save it to necessarily.
Yeah, but when I turn the telly off, and I go back to YouTube.
Yeah, you've lost your place.
I've lost my place. Yeah, and I have to start the clip or whatever it was all over again.
I have the same issue because I use an Amazon Fire TV box, which is one of the best boxes to make a dumb TV smart, if you like. And the YouTube app on it is very usable. And now you can do searches by voice as well, which is very nice. But you have that problem. And I tend, it's not very eco-friendly. I tend to leave my TV switched on for just that reason. If you want to be using sort of libraries of videos and so forth, then it is better to use... do you have a tablet or a smartphone or a computer that you can use for this purpose?
Yes, but I'm just sitting there watching television and say, I was watching tonight something about, I can't remember what it was now, something to do with a Wallace Simpson, and the programme is 40 minutes long, and I think, well, that looks interesting. I watched 5 minutes of it, and then I had to turn it off, 10 minutes of it, what it was. But now I've got to go back. I know I can find it again, but I've got to start from the beginning again, because if you try and forward YouTube, you're in big trouble, because it then You know what I mean? It's not reliable, is it?
So if the source of your television were not YouTube, if it was, for example, Freeview or Freesat...
Which it is.
Well, if you're watching from Freeview or Freesat, then you can buy a box. For example, Humax make set-top boxes that not only allow you to watch those programs, but also will some of them have an internal hard drive that you can save them to. So it will do something very similar to what Sky does for its own proprietary system. So Sky allows you to record onto an internal hard drive, but you have to have a Sky subscription to do that. But if you're using as a source of your TV Freeview or Freesat, then you can get one of these set-top boxes, for example, the Humax, but other brands are also, you know, good.
When I turn on my television, it goes Freesat Humax. That comes up.
So you've got a Humax box there?
Yes, I must have, mustn't I?
Sounds like it, yeah, because yes. As far as I know, Humax don't build stuff into TV sets, so it sounds like you've got
separately... No, I've got a box, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So some of those boxes are more basic in that all they do is they allow you to see the TV show on the TV screen. You know, they'll take the image from the antenna or from the satellite dish if it's Freesat, and then display it on the screen. But others in that range have got storage inside them, and they come with what's called an electronic program guide, which is on the Humaxes is very good, by the way. It's very easy to see and understand what's coming up in the next week or two. But some of them have got storage built into them as well, if you go up the range a bit. And then you can then store them and save them.
So how would I access the storage bit if I got it?
It would have an internal drive. And using the menu-based system from your remote control, you would go into the programs that you'd stored, the library of programs that you'd stored, and you would be able to choose from that and display that on the screen. The other way forward, and your TV may support this, is your TV fairly modern?
Oh, 18 months.
Okay. A lot of TVs, modern TVs, which they will all have Freeview built into them, by the way, so you don't need to have a separate Humax box for this. A lot of them have got a USB socket on it. That's a rectangular socket that's about 1.5 centimeters high and about 0.5 centimeter wide, a rectangle. With a lot of modern TVs, they have the ability to record Freeview onto a USB drive, and that can be one of those little thumb drives that you just plug in. Looks like a little market pen type thing, or even an external hard drive if you want more capacity. So you should check your TV, because you may already have the capability built into the telly to record, but it would just require the USB drive to be plugged in. So that's worth looking into, because that's quite a neat solution as well.
Okay, I'll try that one.
Rebecca, good luck.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. That's Rebecca in Somerset. Gave us a call on 08085 909 693, as did Paul in Liverpool. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. You've got a dual boot problem, I gather.
Yeah, I use Ubuntu, and I dual boot my laptop with Windows 10.
Yeah.
Now, I've given the laptop to my child, and he's only using Windows. But I don't seem to be able to get rid of Ubuntu off the hard drive. I was wondering if you could just help me out. Just getting rid of that operating system.
Yeah, so it's probably just worth explaining what dual boot is for those that don't know. So a computer normally has just one operating system on it, be it Windows 7, Windows 10, Mac OS, whatever it is. And booting is the process of starting up that machine, and it loads the operating system. Boot is short for bootstrap, by the way, because you pull yourself up by the bootstraps. The computer is pulling itself up from its dead state to its living state, as it were, by its bootstraps. So that's why it's called booting. Most computers will just have the one, and they will start up the operating system as you switch it on. If you want to be able to run more than one operating system, and you don't want to run virtual machines, which is what we alluded to earlier in the program, then you use what's called dual boot, where as you switch on the machine, it gives you a choice of which of the two operating systems that you've installed on your machine you want to use on this occasion. So on one occasion, you use Ubuntu, on another, you use Windows 10. The way that this is usually done is that the one physical hard drive is partitioned into two hard drives. So it's not not physically split, but it appears to the computer to be two separate drives. So instead of having just a C drive, you might have a C and D. It's still physically one drive, but it's partitioned into two. So if you want to get rid of one of those, what you need to do is, what you will do in the process of doing it is to get rid of the partition that you no longer want. And the reason that you would want to do that is then you can recover that space for use by the remaining operating system. Because
That's the reason. You've got 500 gigabytes of space for Ubuntu on, on a 1 terabyte hard drive.
Yeah. That's overkill. Well, it depends what you're doing. If you're using Ubuntu to download lots of TV box sets or something.
Well, when I installed it, I just decided to do half and half.
Yeah,
just made
probably
500 gig and left the Windows 500 gig.
So there are software tools that allow you to manipulate the partitions on a hard drive without losing the data. But what I would suggest to you you do is you back up all the data on each partition. So boot it as Windows, do a full backup, boot it as Ubuntu, do another backup. And then are you wanting to do away with Ubuntu altogether or just reduce?
Only on the laptop, yeah. I mean, I use Ubuntu, yeah. I don't use Windows at all, but...
Yeah, but you don't need it on there anymore because your son... Did you say it was your son's machine?
It's my son, yeah. He's not very... So, yeah, I think Ubuntu's a bit advanced.
So... It depends. If you've not got any data on there that you need, you can just delete the partition.
That's all I need to do. There's nothing I really need to back up on that. That was just a trial.
Yeah, so you can do away with the partition and then allow it just to boot into Windows as normal.
Yeah.
It depends. How is the Windows? Is there lots of stuff on the Windows that would need to be retained?
There's a fair bit. I mean, if I broke the computer and it crashed and I lost all the data, it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Yeah.
Okay. I would just reinstall Windows, but I'd prefer to be able to delete that partition and resize the hard drive back to a terabyte.
Yeah, so the most solid way of doing that is to format the whole drive, both partitions, and redo it as a single partition and then reinstall Windows and everything on it. That's going to give you potentially the best and most stable outcome. But it's not convenient because it means you've got to back everything up and reinstate it and have all the disks or know where to download all the software. Yeah, so that's probably a day's work. Failing that, you can use software tools to extend a partition so that the Windows partition will extend over the whole drive and use all the storage space. So you can do that, but it's a bit of a tweak. I personally...
What software would you use? What software would be the best to download?
I was just trying to think because I haven't done it for a while. I think Acronis may have software that does it. It's part of their backup suite. But I would have to look at it because, to be honest, it's a long time since I've had to repartition hard drives. But
Partition Magic, is that one?
Yeah, does Partition Magic still exist? Because I used to use it so many years ago. Okay, well, Partition Magic was excellent. So if it's still going and compatible, then yes, absolutely. It's so funny because in these days of capacious hard drives, I just really haven't had that problem for a long time. But Partition Magic was best of breed. Thanks, Tom. That would do it. And, that's probably one of the software applications that I would actually trust to do this because... And before you do it, still back up your Windows system
we'll back everything
because
up
whatever
anyway,
no slight on Partition Magic, that's probably the best of the bunch actually.
Well, know what? I think I might give you a bum steer. I'm just checking; it's not Windows 10 compatible. So there you go.
Yeah, I must admit, I've got one on my shelf that says Windows 95.
Yeah, it's been around a long time.
Around a long time. Yeah. So I could have a look into this for you again if you post me on Twitter at Gadget Detective. I'll look into it for a good, because you've got to get a reliable tool to do this. It has to be a trustworthy tool, and I just haven't done it for a while. So but as I say, even if you're going to use a tool like that, do back up your Windows first, because even the best of tools, things can go wrong. But I would say to you that the proper way of doing it would be to wipe everything, repartition the drive, and do it from scratch. And that will give you when was the last time you reinstalled Windows, can I ask you, on that machine?
Oh, I haven't done that for a long time.
So you'll have some performance benefits as well. How old is the machine?
Yeah, the machine's quite old, to be fair. It's probably about 3 years old.
Yeah, so I would say you know, whilst you can use Partition Magic or a sort of Windows 10 equivalent, I would say that reinstalling Windows, although it's a pain, will give you a more stable outcome, and it will also give you better performance because you'll have less sort of cruft that will have accumulated through various program installations and uninstallations and bits being knocked off the operating system by accident. You know, that would probably be the better solution, but it will take you a few hours, unfortunately.
Right, so you would say just bite the bullet, back it off, and just reinstall it.
I would, because you're going to have to do that. You're going to have to do the backup anyway. Yeah, it really depends on how complex all of this is. You can send me that message via Twitter, and I will find you a tool that does that. And you could try it first and see if you're happy with it. But bear in mind, must do the backup first, because you can lose all your data in the process of trying to resize a partition.
Paul, best of luck.
Right, and just one more as well. If I did completely wipe it, I done that Windows upgrade free of charge when it come out.
You've still got a license.
Forced to. When the laptop boots up and it starts reinstalling Windows from the recovery drive, that's right, will it automatically load up Windows 10, or will it still get, or will it load Windows 7, and then will it get the option to upgrade?
I wouldn't
to Windows
do that. I wouldn't go back to the recovery drive, which will give you, was it Windows 7 it was originally?
I think so, yeah. Or Windows 8.
I mean, if it was Windows 7, I'd leave it where it was, and I wouldn't bother with 10, frankly. But yeah, if it's Windows 8, then you might as well go for 10, because Windows 8.
Wouldn't bother with Windows, to be fair, if I had way.
That's another thing. But joking aside, if it was Windows 7, my advice is just let it go back to Windows 7 and leave it at Windows 7. If it was Windows 8 or 8.1, then instead of reinstating from the recovery disk 8 and 8.1 and then upgrading it to 10, I would download an installable version of Windows 10 from the Microsoft website and install that fresh rather than do the update. Yeah.
Paul, thank you very much, mate. Best of luck with that. You can always tweet to Fevzy as well, at Gadget Detective. Anne is in Devon. Good morning, Anne.
Hello.
How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you.
Oh, what's your question for Fevzy?
I've got a Mac 27. It's 9 years old. The screen seems to freeze and then shake, and then it's okay. I did phone Apple, and they thought it could be the graphics card, which is now obsolete.
Yes.
I wondered if there's anything I could do.
So is this a 27-inch iMac, or is that
a big Mac? You know, iMac.
It's a big box and a separate screen, or the computer's built into the screen.
It's a screen, a keyboard, and a mouse.
Okay, but there isn't a separate box sitting external to that.
No.
Okay. So it could well, Apple will be the best people to answer this question because it's their kit, but it could well be a hardware issue, in which case.
There's nothing I can do.
Well, it's probably not an economic repair, because what you're going to have to do is pay someone to open it and then source an old graphics card or circuit, or if it's integrated onto the main circuit board, replace the whole main circuit board. Either way, that's quite a bit of money to spend on a machine of that age. Because although Macs are nice, I mean, you must be running quite an old version of the OS 10 operating system.
Yeah.
So again, what you've got there is you've got some security issues as well, and you've got lack of support. What are you mainly using it for, Anne?
I use it for ordering online, banking. I'm a Wally. I am useless at this. I've also got an iPad, which I use sort of mainly. Yeah. So basically, we're thinking we're throwing it away and we get a new one. I've got a separate memory box which stands alone. So if I went out and bought a new Mac and plugged that in, does everything reappear, or have I got to get a tech in to install things?
So let me just take one step back. Just before we write off this machine, I would say two things to you about it. One is it could be a software issue. It might not be the hardware. It could be, as we've talked about before, driver.
You're breaking
issue.
Up again badly. You know, you've got a very bad line tonight.
I think it's an issue with our phone lines, actually, and I apologise for that. But bear with us if you can.
Yeah.
Is it coming that way to you as well, Tom?
No. I think it's all right. It's all right to me. I think it's all right in the radio. I think it's a problem with the phone.
Transmission.
Must be the line because all right. Listening to the previous caller, it was bad. But listening to on the television, it's fine. You know, so it's obviously the phone line that's a problem.
The irony of a technology fail during a technology fail.
I just wondered, the reason I asked the question is I was wondering if it's something at this end causing the problem. So before we give up on your Mac, so we look at whether it could be a software issue. We go back to Apple and we ask them about drivers, and we ask them for to point us in the right direction of the most current driver that they have for that hardware. Apple are not great at supporting legacy hardware. They're kind of learning to do that as they've increased their sales and have a bigger user base, but it's worth asking them the question. There will be a driver that's suitable, and it's worth reinstalling that driver and see if that solves the problem. So the
I must admit, last time when I phoned them up, they literally said, which what you suggested once upon a time was unplug a machine for 10 seconds or 20 seconds or 2 minutes or something, or 10 minutes and then plug it back in again. And that's really all they suggested.
That can solve problems, but it doesn't solve everything, unfortunately.
Didn't do it this time.
So, no. So that would be my advice. Go back and ask them about the software drivers for the graphics circuit, and they ask them to send you a link or something where you can download it and try and do that. The other thing I suppose you could try is you could try plugging in an external screen if there's an output socket, but I think on a 9-year-old Mac it might not be.
I wouldn't know how to do that anyway.
The final thing that you can do is you take it to an independent repairer and you negotiate a no fix, no fee. But the problem is, even if they fix it, it's not going to be a £50 repair. It's going to be 100 plus. And for a machine of that age, I would start putting my money towards a new machine.
Yeah, okay. So can you answer the next question then? If I do that, and as I say, I've got this memory box that's plugged into the back with a USB, when I get a new machine and plug it in, does everything just reappear on the screen, or have I got to get a man in to sort of set me up with email addresses and all the different things that I have on there?
So what you're describing is a memory box, I'm assuming, is an external hard disk drive. Would that ring any bells? So it's where you store the things that you create, the documents and pictures and so forth.
I think memory box is a nicer name.
It is a nice name, actually. It's very descriptive. So thank you for that. So yes and no, it depends what it is. So if you've got pictures on there, the pictures will still be on there and you should be able to access them from a new machine.
Right.
The problem comes with other types of files, like document files. They will be in a certain format. In other words, that information will have been written according to certain rules that are used by the software that you're currently running on your 9-year-old computer.
Right.
So the programs themselves would need to be reinstalled or replaced with their modern equivalents. And then you would have to, so let's say you'd have a modern word processor and a modern spreadsheet and whatever else, accounting software, whatever it is you're using, your browser and all of that. Now, where those programs access files, like a word processor opens a file, you can't assume it will just be able to access those files, because it has to have the right sort of what's called backward compatibility. So the word processor in this example would need to be able to access the files created by that 9-year-old piece of hardware and software. So no, it's not. I think it
doesn't all happen just magically.
No, it doesn't. And certainly your email and everything would have to be set up again. I just think it's too old to try and do any sort of meaningful migration of everything. So yes, either you would at that point either get a man or a woman in to help you with that.
So would it be better to get someone in to sort of try and take off all the information off the old machine and then put all that on the new machine?
Yes, I think
that would be the way to do it.
I think it's worth paying £50 to someone to do that.
Yeah.
And unless they're a relative of yours that you trust, watch them whilst they do it to make sure they don't make a copy for themselves.
They don't want.
Make sure they don't. You watch them so they make sure. I don't want to impugn anyone, but if it's sensitive information, then you have to be present whilst they're copying it and understand what's being done on your machine and on your data.
And thank you very much for giving us a call. I'm afraid we're out of time on the Tech Phone In. Fevzi, it's been a pleasure as ever. Thank you for coming on at Gadget Detective on Twitter if you want to catch Fevzi.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.